BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Tom Sutcliffe and this is Start the Week from BBC Radio 4. Hope you enjoy the programme. All societies, all nations have their systems for dealing with crime and retribution. But what happens when countries commit crimes, either against their own citizens or those of another country? And how will the battle for universal human rights fare as the most powerful nations continue to insist on their right to be exempted from collective judgment? With us to talk about that today is a veteran of the fight to make nations and leaders accountable for their actions, Kenneth Roth, former executive director of the pressure group Human Rights Watch and author of Righting Wrongs, a handbook for those determined to ensure that might does not equal right. Joining him are Lina Sinjab, a Middle East correspondent for the BBC who saw the abuses of the Assad regime in Syria at first hand and has reported from that country before and after the regime's overthrow, and the writer and lawyer Philippe Sands, whose latest book, 38 Londres Street, tells the story of General Pinochet's arrest in 1998 and the subsequent legal battles to bring him to justice for crimes committed against political opponents in Chile after the 1973 coup. I want to start by asking you all the same question. Kenneth Roth, you open your book by quoting that famous remark by Martin Luther King that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. A lot of people will feel at the moment that it is bending away from justice. Are you pessimistic or optimistic at the moment about where we stand?
I included that quote in the book because people don't recognize the later quote in the same speech by Dr. King, where he basically admitted that it doesn't bend toward justice without a struggle. It requires pressure. And that's what the book is about. There is nothing inevitable about the bending toward justice. It takes pressure on governments that are determined to act unjustly. And what I do in the book is essentially outline how even the worst despots, the worst dictators, you know, whether it's Xi Jinping in China, Vladimir Putin in Russia, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, Paul Kagame in Rwanda, they all are susceptible to pressure. And I show in the book how we have been able to move them.
Yeah, that arc need not be a pure arc. It's kind of bumpy, isn't it, sometimes? Lina, it's a very specific moment in Syrian history at the moment. Does it fill you with optimism, or are you still wary?
I think, you know, before December 8th, you know, I was living in Lebanon as a Syrian myself. I've lost hope. I've lost faith in the international community. I felt that I will never see a free Syria myself in my own generation. And I was looking for somewhere else to live because I felt like there's no hope in the whole Middle East. But then December 8th happens and I jump in, you know, first hours and go there and I've experienced how Syrians are living this moment of free Syria, free speech. People are speaking their minds, are feeling they own their country. They can do stuff. They can work. They can do stuff for their own country. That filled me with you know, a lot of optimism. But I think it's going to take a long way towards real democracy. But we're on the way.
And you have to rebuild the system of justice within the country as well, which is crucial.
It's not only the justice system. It's like you need to start from scratch because this is a country that's been under a dictatorship for five decades or over. And it's like built on corruption, on nepotism. And it's in lying in poverty and in destruction that Assad has left. So you need to work on all levels to reach a moment for people to live in peacefully.
Philippe Sands, what about you? You wrote a book, East West Street, which was about the high point of kind of human rights, the moment at which crimes against humanity and genocide were put into law for the first time.
Sure. I mean, I think coming back to your question, justice is a long game. I start my book, 38 Londres Street, with a 16th century quote on the dangers of impunity. It's something we've long known about. And that 1945 moment that you've just referred to, when these new international crimes were established, was crucial. But in the scheme of things, it's relatively recent. And so these things take time. Nothing much happened after the 1945 moment until the late 1990s, when a whole series of events occurred, the creation of the International Criminal Court, the indictment of Slobodan Milosevic, and of course, the story that I tell, the unexpected arrest of Augusto Pinochet in London. So that's a long game.
Yeah, that's your book, 38 Londres Street. Tell us about that address. Why does the book start there? Where is it?
The book is a double story, actually. It tells the story of Augusto Pinochet's arrest in London on the 16th of October 1998, just a few hundred yards from where we're sitting, actually, and his relationship with a Nazi called Walter Rauff, who was the man who ran the mobile gas vans over a couple of years in 1941 and 42, and ended up living in Chile, brought to Chile by Augusto Pinochet. And that double story really is catalyzed by the moment in October 1998 when four officers from Scotland Yard, accompanied by Jean Pateras, the interpreter, entered room 801 of the London Clinic on Devonshire Place.
You haven't called it room 801, though. Why is it called 38 Londres Street?
Because 38 Londres Street is an address in the centre of Santiago. It used to be the headquarters of the Socialist Party. Allende's offices was acquired by Augusto Pinochet's regime shortly after the coup in September 1973, and it became one of the principal centres for detention and torture. But it was also a place where one of the former detainees, Leon Gomez, told me he had been personally interrogated and tortured by Walter Rauff. So it is the point of connection between the two men.
It's the one moment where you get those two men together. You were initially approached to be part of Pinochet's legal team, and you approve of the cab rank principle that says you take the next case that comes along. Why didn't you in the end?
Because I'm married to a fabulous American attorney who thinks the cab rank principle is nonsense and you do the cases you want to do. I am a believer passionately of the cab rank principle. I told her I had been approached by General Pinochet's lawyers and explained the cab rank principle. She said, you know what I think about the cab rank principle. Are you going to do it? I sort of mumbled about the cab rank principle, and she said, well, you can do it if you want, but I'll divorce you tomorrow if you do it. And we're still happily married 30 years on.
Why did Pinochet feel confident that he could come to London, and why was it that Baltasar Garzon, the Spanish magistrate, thought, well, I can get you?
Pinochet felt he was safe for a number of reasons. He had immunity under Chilean law. He believed, wrongly as it turned out, that he also had a diplomatic immunity, but he also believed he was very close to the British. There was a new government in Britain that had been elected shortly before he arrived, and he'd been actually advised that things would be different under Labour than under the Conservatives. He felt he had the personal protection of Margaret Thatcher, and the reason for that was that it turned out Chile had provided very significant military support, including an airstrip not so far from where Walter Rauff lived in Punta Arenas, which had been used by the British in the Falklands-Malvinas War. So for all of those reasons, he actually ignored the advice he'd been given by Chilean army colleagues, thought he was safe, could come and was protected, and that was a huge mistake.
And what was the loophole that, or not even a loophole, what was the mechanism that Garzon used in order to get you?
Well, the principle is something called universal jurisdiction, which is the idea that there are certain crimes that are so horrendous, crimes against humanity, genocide, torture, disappearance, which allow any country in the world to exercise jurisdiction over those crimes. And so what happened was Baltasar Garzon, actually on a tip-off from the British Embassy in Madrid, sends a request for his arrest in London for genocide and crimes against humanity, and that is actioned by Scotland Yard. And it is the first time in history that a former head of state of one country is arrested in another country for an international crime and claims immunity.
We haven't got time to go into all of the twists and turns of the case, but it is a succession of cliffhangers, isn't it? I mean, initially he's charged with murder. That has to be changed. Why did that come about, that particular twist?
There's an amazing series of coincidences in this book, and one of them is that my next-door neighbour, our garden's abut, happens to be the magistrate who signed the arrest warrant for Augusto Pinochet, a wonderful former magistrate called Nick Evans. And he, as he explained to me, it was a time in the late 90s where the words genocide, crimes against humanity, torture were not in vogue. They weren't being talked about. And when the Scotland Yard extradition squad turned up at his house with a draft arrest warrant, he looked at these words, genocide, torture, crimes against humanity, and thought, I don't know what these are, crosses them out and writes murder. The problem with that, and it was an innocent sort of well-intentioned mistake, was that there's no jurisdiction in English courts for the ordinary crime of murder. It has to be an international crime in order to allow the English courts and the Spanish courts to exercise jurisdiction.
So they, in fact, they had time to kind of redraft.
Well, what actually happens is that he is then arrested on the crime of murder, but the Chilean lawyers and the English solicitor who then advise him on the Saturday and the Sunday, the 17th and the 18th of October 1998, haven't spotted the error. That is only spotted on the Monday the 19th, when a barrister becomes involved, Clay Montgomery, who spots the difficulty. But by then, Baltasar Garzón in Madrid has spotted the difficulty and has issued a second arrest warrant, which clears up the mess.
You raise the question of immunity for heads of state, and it's sometimes argued that immunity is a useful device, that it allows the end of a regime. And indeed, in Chile, it probably did. I mean, Augusto Pinochet was able to accept the result of a referendum because he knew he wouldn't face any consequences in Chile.
It's very complex. Argentina had no immunity rule, and of course they had their first trials of the generals as early as 1985, and so the consequence was very different. Nothing happened in Chile until he was arrested here. But the immunity rule for a serving head of state, I can see the rationale for that. But for a former head of state, it's different. And of course, this is very relevant right now, because just last year, the United States Supreme Court gave a judgment saying that a former US president has a presumptive immunity in relation to any official act. And that's very problematic.
Kenneth Roth, I don't know what you feel about that.
Now, as I explain in my book, Righting Wrongs, the common wisdom that dictators cling to power and that, you know, they would give up power if you just gave them immunity does not correspond with reality, because dictators by their nature cling to power till the very end, until they can no longer do it. They're overthrown. There's sufficient popular resistance that they can't hang on. And at that point, they have no capacity to insist on an amnesty. So, in fact, if you give them an amnesty, you're only encouraging tomorrow's dictators to commit mass atrocities, figuring they'll bargain for an amnesty, too. So I think this entire view that amnesties are necessary for democratic transitions is historically untrue and politically unwise.
Lina, was there any discussion in Syria about the possibility of a sort of truth and reconciliation process rather than, you know, trial and...
Well, I think this is the main issue for Syrians is transitional justice and how the perpetrators of war crimes, including Assad, are going to be brought to justice so that the country move on and people heal with their wounds of the war. And I think
many of those criminals are now in Russia. I mean, you were saying before
hundreds of them. Yes, hundreds of them are reported to be in Russia, but mainly the top, security officers and army officers who've ordered the killing, who've ordered the, you know, chemical attack use and the barrel bomb use, and also the torture inside prisons. They are reported to be in Russia, but many of them are inside Syria. Yeah. And the new authorities, they're still finding their ways around, and they haven't handled this issue in a clear way that will bring people to, heal with their wounds so far.
Yeah. I mean, there is always that possibility, isn't there, to escape. I mean, this is where Walter Rauf comes in. He is arraigned, this former SS man.
So Walter
he escapes.
Walter Rauf commits, I mean, heinous crimes throughout the 1940s, first in relation to the gas vans, then in Tunisia, then in Italy, where he's still a hated person today, in Milan, where he was the head of the Gestapo. He escapes, goes to Damascus, actually, ironically, and ends up being the advisor to the president in Damascus, then heads back to Italy and ends up in Chile. 20 years on, in December 62, he is arrested on a warrant from a West German prosecutor for crimes against humanity and genocide. And he is taken up to Santiago, stands trial for extradition. And the Chilean justices, by 6-1, the Supreme Court, votes that there is a limitation period of 15 years, even for international crimes. And his crimes have happened more than 20 years earlier, so he can't be extradited.
You work very hard to research his connections with Pinochet, and there is a huge amount of hearsay. And you can understand that. A lot of the opponents of the regime like the idea that there might be a connection with a former Nazi. It sort of fits their worldview. Did you find enough evidence yourself that you would have brought a charge?
I arrived in Chile to a myriad of rumours that Rauf definitely worked for Pinochet and his hated intelligence service, the DINA, but no evidence. And in particular, one of the things that was learned from the German experience was to destroy all documents. So I was left with witness testimony. And eventually, I found several former detainees of Pinochet's intelligence service who'd been tortured either by Ralph or by people in association with Ralph. But more significantly, and this was much more delicate and complex, I came to know two former DINA agents who were able to give me absolutely comprehensive evidence of and accounts, personal accounts of having seen Walter Rauff with Pinochet's most hated associate, Manuel Contreras, who ran the intelligence service. I took all of this in the end to a Supreme Court justice in Chile. He said, absolutely, it's established, you have established it. So I'm pretty clear there was a connection.
What bearing does all of this have right now on the cases of Putin and also Benjamin Netanyahu, who a case has been brought against him? There are places he can't go and or won't go.
I mean, there's two types of bearing. The first is the sort of formal technical bearing, is that a serving head of state, as I said, in principle, has an absolute immunity from the jurisdiction of any courts. National, certainly, possibly international, this is debated right now. But for me, I think the bigger issue, and the reason I was interested in looking for the connections between Pinochet and Ralph, was to look at the long-term consequences of doing nothing. And the long-term consequences, I think, are very significant. One of the reasons Ralph was able to resume his career, it's very shocking, is that he never was apprehended, he never was charged and indicted successfully, never got his day in court. And I think that creates a space in which things that have happened in the 1940s can resume in the 1970s. And I think we've got exactly the same situation today. It's why, you know, the work of Lena and Ken, I think it's just so important on underscoring do nothing is not an option.
Lena Sinjab, I want to turn to you now. You grew up under the Assad regime. This is not theoretical for you. You saw these things firsthand, and first under Hafez al-Assad and then under Bashar. Was there any difference between those two regimes?
Well, I can quote one veteran Syrian opposition, Riyad al-Turk, who spent years in prison describing Assad the son, a dictatorship without a dictator. So he copied the manuscript of his father on how to apply dictatorship, but he didn't fit the position that, you know, his father made everyone scared around him. And that's why we saw in 2011 when the uprising, you know, began, people say that, you know, Hafez al-Assad destroyed Hama, killed 30,000 in Hama. His son destroyed all Syria because, you know, he didn't have the vision to find a way to reconcile with people, please people with their demands, but rather used violence to mimic his father's, his way of crushing people's demands. Growing up under the father, you know, it was like complete fear, you know. I remember at home, we never mentioned the word Ra'is or president. It was too scary to mention it. Under the sun, there was a room of like talking, feeling optimistic about the future, that, you know, there's a new young man who educated in the UK is coming to rule the country. So people felt there is some hope. There was the Damascus Spring. People started to talk about politics. But then it just immediately started. He's cracking down on people, arresting opposition. And it was clear that everything is tailored for his own entourage of community to be in a better place.
You reported from inside the country until 2013, I think, presumably with huge constraints.
Well, I was accredited as a BBC correspondent inside Syria, mainly reporting for the English service. And it was really, you're always thinking about what you say, how to say it, and keeping the balance, but also keeping your own, credit as an independent journalist. So you feel as if you're walking in minelands, and you have to keep watching your steps all the time, what you say, how you say it, and you know how to tailor it to be able to avoid being imprisoned. I remember in 2011, I was working on corruption documentary for Radio 4 in Syria, and, you know, talking about the brother-in-law, Rami Makhlouf, about how he manipulated and took over the whole economy in the country. And I was really worried how this is going to be received when it will be on air. It was on air in February 2011. And it was just like right before the start of the uprising. And it felt like, you know, silence has broken in Syria afterwards. So you started talking not about corruption, but about war crimes that are happening. And, you know, you just moved on with it.
And in your view, Kenneth writes a lot about, as it were, the use of shame in kind of countering human rights abuses. Do you think that would have worked with Bashar al-Assad? I mean, he clearly wanted to appear a certain way in the eyes of kind of Western countries.
Well, the issue with Assad is that he never told the truth. And, you know, even on in terms of like in internal meetings, I remember in the early days of 2011 when Douma, there were attacks on Douma before the massacre of the chemical weapons in 2013. One of his, army officers went to Douma, talked to people, and I'm quoting here Manaf Tlas, who defected in that year. He gave them promises by the name of Assad. He took them to meet Assad. He took a delegation from Douma, which is an eastern suburb of Damascus, to meet with Bashar al-Assad. At the time of the meeting, his security forces were crushing Douma, killing and arresting many people. So that's the narrative that he always, you know, followed. And even when, you know, the media faced him with many of his crimes, he just like made all the, you know, this is a conspiracy theory. These are Photoshop photos. These are maps made in Qatar. This is he completely in denial all the time. And of course, the media machine around him in Damascus was just feeding into that.
Kenneth Rother, there's a very chilling story in your book about Human Rights Watch or another organisation persuading rebel hospitals to share their coordinates with the Syrian government in order to prevent accidental bombings. And what happened was that the bombings became more accurate. That suggests that shame just wasn't working in this case, doesn't it?
Well, first I should clarify, it was the UN that persuaded the hospitals to share their coordinates.
Right,
I never
would
have urged that. And it was the Syrian and Russian bombers that then attacked the hospitals more precisely.
Yeah.
But I actually open my book, Righting Wrongs, with this example from Idlib, the province in northwestern Syria, which was the only province still held by the armed opposition until just recently. And on the question of shame, I mean, I focused on this because if anybody was beyond shame, it was Assad. I mean, as Lena notes, he still lied. He still covered up his atrocities, but they were well known. And what I try to show is that the defense of human rights is not just about shaming. It's also about generating pressure. And in that case, we went to Merkel, the German chancellor, Macron, the French president, and Erdogan, the Turkish president, and persuaded them to put pressure on Putin to stop the bombing, because they were deliberately bombing not just hospitals, but also marketplaces, schools, apartment buildings. And it took 2 to 3 years of intense pressure. But finally, in March 2020, Putin agreed. And for the next 3 years, the 3 million civilians in Idlib were suddenly not facing daily death from the skies. And it picked up a little bit after that, but basically ended definitively this past December when Idlib was the source of the HTS rebels that overthrew Assad. So this showed that even in a seemingly hopeless situation, a path can be found to stop mass atrocities.
What part does, as it were, military pressure play in this? I don't know what you feel about this, Lena. Obama famously did not react when his own red line was crossed in Syria with the use of chemical weapons. The parliament in this country voted against military action there. Did that embolden Bashar?
Definitely so. I mean, at that time, Bashar really felt the pressure and immediately made the promises of handing over all the chemical weapons, allowed international team to come in and investigate from the OCPW. But at the same time, he didn't hand over everything because we discovered later on that he continued using chemical weapons against his own people. And the problem is that he basically started using conventional weapons. That's when, after Obama's red line, barrel bombs started, and the number of Syrians who were killed with barrel bombs exceeded the ones who were killed in chemical attacks. However, he still used the chemical weapons in Khan Sheikhoun in 2016. So he never stopped using it against his own people. And I think at that time, many Syrians felt disappointed because they felt they've adhered to the international communities, the justice, the human rights laws, the protection of civilians. And they felt what mattered for international, super leaders is the, not use of chemical weapons because of protection of the, Israeli side, not rather than the protection of the Syrian people.
You raise an interesting, Philippe, there's an interesting question raised there just about the categories of crimes and how some seem to have this special status. So if you drop chemical weapons on somebody, that is somehow much, much worse than if you kill them with barrel bombs. If you take it to the level of genocide, that is much, much worse than a crime against humanity. Are they useful, these distinctions?
I mean, the moment of 1945 was hugely important in recognising that all individuals have rights because they are human beings, and that groups have rights because individuals are members of groups. And we've got these sort of three-tier categories of international crimes: war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. And what has happened over time, regrettably in my view, is that genocide has become seen as the crime of crimes. It's a terrible crime, but in my view, so are crimes against humanity, and so are war crimes. And I don't personally have a hierarchy. I mean, for example, the killing of 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men in Srebrenica, characterized as the crime of genocide. Is that worse than the killing of 3 million human beings in the Democratic Republic of Congo in approximately the same period, because that's only a war crime or a crime against humanity? In my view, the answer is not. They're all on a level playing field. They're all equally terrible. But on this point of red lines, I think that the issue that arose then in relation to Syria was that it's one thing to have red lines, fine, but you've got to have a plan for what you're actually going to do. And I remember that vote in the British Parliament, and I personally was against the use of force at that point, not because I objected to a red line, but because I couldn't see a plan. And we've learnt, for example, with Libya, that if you just decide to use force to protect human rights, which broadly I'm in favour of, unless you've got a plan for what follows subsequently, which could include boots on the ground, it's most likely not going to work, and think carefully before you open that door.
Lina, there is very little prospect at the moment that Bashar al-Assad will face a reckoning. He's safe in Russia. In the event that he does, do you think he should be tried in Syria or in The Hague? Is there a difference between those eventual outcomes?
I think we're looking at the prospects of years to come. And if Syria got on the right path of having independent civil jurisdiction, many Syrians would like to see Bashar al-Assad tried inside Syria. But I think that's also going to be a long way for Syria to move to that stage. So probably, it's more realistic to have him in the ICC. Wherever he should be tried, he should be tried and under international human rights laws for the, genocide and the killings and the crimes that he committed.
Kenneth Roth, you wanted to come in there.
And I agree with Lina that domestic justice is always better. But we are nowhere near having that be possible within Syria. So the International Criminal Court is the only option. That brings up, well, how does it get jurisdiction? And there are two routes. One would be for the interim Syrian authorities, now al-Shara, to accept the International Criminal Court and give it retroactive jurisdiction. They are hesitating, and we don't know entirely why. I think it's partly because the current authorities have their own war crimes to their name in the past, and they may be worried. I think that's probably unlikely where the ICC would focus. But there also may be pressure from Turkey and the United States that have forces in Syria and that don't want ICC jurisdiction. The other thing is that Karim Khan, the ICC chief prosecutor, could pursue the same theory in Syria that he used in Myanmar to recently charge the Myanmar junta chief. And that is, even though Myanmar never joined the court, once the Rohingya were forced into Bangladesh, which is an ICC member, the crime of forced deportation gave the court jurisdiction. That same theory in Syria would say when Assad's atrocities forced Syrians into Jordan, an ICC member, they could prosecute. Now, this still is the question, okay, well, how do you get Assad? Slobodan Milosevic, the former Serbian leader, thought he was home free, but he faked an electoral win. There was a popular uprising. He had to step down. And the new Syrian government, the new Serbian government, to get out of sanctions, handed Milosevic to The Hague. You can imagine the same thing in Russia. Putin dies at some point. He's probably not well. The new Russian government, wanting to get out from under the sanctions, says, well, what do we have to do? They have to turn over Assad.
He's an inconvenience, I imagine, already, but he becomes an even bigger inconvenience.
Pinochet is the example that the unexpected really can happen. But just a slight tweak on Kenneth's point. I mean, I'm actually rather more in favour of domestic jurisdictions, that there is a principle in international law of complementarity. The ICC is a backstop. It's very important in exercising pressure and leverage, but ultimately it's for the countries where the crimes occurred in first instance to seek to exercise jurisdiction, and that's an important principle. In the Libyan case that I mentioned earlier, ironically, Saif Gaddafi, who is indicted by the International Criminal Court, would prefer to be tried in the ICC rather than in the Libyan courts, for the very simple reason that there's no death penalty at the ICC. And that is also a factor, I think, that tends to concentrate the mind.
It gives me the cue to come on to Kenneth and his book. You talk about shifting a government's cost-benefit calculation. That would be one element of that, I'm sure. And your book, you present as a kind of primer on tools and techniques. What are the methods that Human Rights Watch used?
I mean, the reason I wrote the book is that, you know, when I tell people that I defend human rights, they kind of look at me and say, well, isn't that nice? You know, I'm sure you're well-intentioned. What can you possibly do? And what I wanted to show is that the defense of human rights is a matter of hardball, that we assume that governments have their reasons to violate human rights. It's a way to stay in power, to get rid of the opposition. And the job of the human rights community is to intensify pressure sufficiently so that the cost-benefit analysis behind repression shifts. And there are essentially three tools that we use. You know, one is shaming. In today's world, every government has to pretend that it respects human rights. They fall short. And when by careful investigation and publication of their atrocities, we can spotlight that discrepancy between the haughty pretense and the ugly reality, it's delegitimizing, they hate it, and ultimately they recognize they won't get rid of the bad press until they change the bad conduct. You know, second, we realize that, you know, every government wants something from the international community. It could be arms sales, military aid, you know, just an invitation to a fancy summit so they can be photographed with respected leaders. And if we can persuade governments like Britain's or France's or Germany's to withhold those benefits until the target government improves its conduct, that generates pressure for change. And then, of course, in the severe case that we've been discussing today, cases like Syria, we can get people prosecuted. And that, you know, everybody wants to stay out of prison.
To what extent does human rights sometimes allow powerful countries to pursue their own realpolitik, that they enlist human rights as a way of, as it were, pursuing their own goals? I mean, the Republican Lindsey Graham, back in 2022, supported the ICC's prosecution of war crimes in Ukraine and said it's marvellous. The ICC has been rehabilitated in the eyes of the American people. I bet he's not saying that anymore.
Au contraire. No, I mean, in fact, I think we have to recognize that, you know, double standards are intrinsic to governments. And that does diminish their credibility. And if you take, for example, the U.S. approach to the International Criminal Court, the U.S., going back to the Rome Conference in 1998 when the ICC was created, they were vehemently opposed because they didn't want the court to have what's known as territorial jurisdiction, the ability to prosecute somebody on the territory of a member state if the perpetrator was a national of a non-member state, because that would mean that they could go after Americans or Israelis. And they opposed the creation of the ICC. They lost by a vote of 120-7, which shows that even the superpowers can be stood up to by coalitions of well-meaning governments. And we helped to orchestrate that. I described that in the book. But then, as you note, when suddenly that territorial jurisdiction was used by the ICC to charge Putin, the U.S. government changed its mind. Biden said the prosecution is justified. Lindsey Graham...
They still didn't sign up to the ICC.
And they will never sign up because they would have to ratify that, which would take 2/3 of the Senate. No way. But Lindsey Graham did orchestrate a unanimous Senate resolution. I describe it in the book, supporting the ICC. And that all disappeared when the ICC charged Netanyahu and the Israeli former defense minister Gallant.
Can we just clarify before we move on, because not everybody will understand it, the distinction between the ICC and the ICJ,
yes.
the International Court of
yes.
Justice?
There are two courts, both put in The Hague just to confuse people. The International Criminal Court, as the name suggests, is a criminal tribunal that prosecutes individuals for war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, or aggression. The International Court of Justice, sometimes called the World Court, is a civil court, so no prosecution. And it resolves disputes between states, or it can answer questions posed to it by the UN General Assembly. And so, for example, South Africa's genocide case against Israel is not a criminal case. It's a request for a determination by the court that Israel is committing genocide. That will have all kinds of ramifications. But
we haven't heard the conclusions of that. I mean, we've only reached the point at which the ICJ has said, OK, you can make the case.
Well, they've gone beyond that. They've actually issued various orders to try to prevent genocide, which Israel's largely ignored.
I mean,
but the merits of the case are a long way to come.
I mean, that word, of course, is regarded by some as kind of completely outrageous word to apply to what Israel
actually,
is
Actually, the
doing.
Court really said very little in its initial provisional measures applications, which is a form of interim relief. I'm not involved in those cases, so I'm able to talk about them with at least some greater distance. The court has not yet decided that it has jurisdiction over the claim. That will take probably 3 or 4 more years. And my experience in other genocide cases, I'm thinking of Croatia versus Serbia, where I was counsel for Croatia, is it took 15 years to reach a final judgment, which was that what happened at Vukovar in the 1990s was not a genocide within the meaning of the convention. And coming back...
And does that bring any consequences with it? Or
huge.
It's just the applying of a label to
huge,
a set of actions?
Huge consequences. To this day, Croatia's failure to establish that what happened at Vukovar was a genocide as compared with what happened at Srebrenica, which both the Yugoslav Tribunal and the International Court of Justice have characterized as a genocide, has had huge consequences within Croatia, deep anger. And this is one of the anxieties that I have, is the gap between what the international courts say constitutes genocide and what regular folk think of as genocide. That gap is getting ever wider. And it's very problematic. If you go back to the writings of Raphael Lemkin, who invented the concept of genocide, who I wrote about in East West Street, in 1944-45, he had a much lower threshold. And Lemkin, I think, on his much lower threshold standard, would have said that what happened on October the 7th in Israel is a genocide, and what has happened subsequently in Gaza is a genocide. But the standard before the international courts is much higher, and that raises the possibility that a different consequence will apply.
Kenneth Roth, what happened when you attempted to get the International Court of Justice to rule that the Iraqi regime had engaged in genocide against the Kurds? Because you had masses of evidence.
Yes.
And it didn't work.
No, and this just shows the evolution of the possibilities of international justice, because I made this effort really in the beginning of the late 1980s, early 1990s, when there were no international tribunals. The possibility of international prosecution was remote. And so we decided to try to pursue Saddam Hussein's genocide against the Kurds, the so-called Anfal genocide, by going to the International Court of Justice and seeking a civil judgment. But because essentially only governments can bring cases there, we had to persuade a government to do this. And the Netherlands was the one most willing to do it. We had extensive conversations with them, but they wanted a coalition around them because they were worried about retaliation by Saddam with terrorism or loss of access to oil in the region. And we, you know, were able to put together a number of European and Latin American governments to join the effort, but not the African and Asian governments that they wanted. So we didn't get any place. It didn't work. And the fact that, you know, today South Africa willingly brings a case of genocide against Israel, you know, Gambia did something very similar with Myanmar for the Rohingya. The world has evolved. And of course, now there is the International Criminal Court, which didn't exist then. So that's why even though, you know, not everything works, I do see a positive trajectory in terms of the possibilities of justice, and I describe that in the book.
Yeah,
and don't forget, Ken, that your early efforts bore fruit later in relation to Syria. There is a case right now at the International Court of Justice brought by Canada and the Netherlands, with other countries joining in relation to the crime of torture, which I think you've you've reported on, Nina.
Yes, and there are lots of also Syrian independent, lawyers and legal activists who are working on these cases, documenting all the crimes that have been done by Assad forces, especially when it comes to torture and imprisonment and disappearance. And they are bringing it up to, their own legal courts, basically, to reach the ICC. But I think also Syrians are really hoping that it's not only these criminals of officers and army officers, but Assad himself will one day be brought to justice.
What do you say to the case that's sometimes made that this is the victory, this is the justice of the victors, that, you know, Hissan Habre will be convicted for crimes in Chad. Putin is very unlikely to face justice. Trump has sanctioned the ICC, I think, for bringing charges against Netanyahu.
I mean, if you go back to the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals, that was victor's justice. It was partial in that sense. And many Western governments did conceive of the International Criminal Court as sort of a parallel to that. They all signed on other than the United States, but they were not happy if it pursued their allies. I think that is beginning to change. I mean, one, Netanyahu totally deserves the charges for the starvation strategy he has pursued in Gaza.
Be people who can't. I mean, he hasn't got a lawyer here to argue the contrary case, but yeah.
But I mean, shall we say the evidence of the starvation strategy is overwhelming, including the fact that he's turning it on and off today as a way to pressure Hamas. The fact that Netanyahu or Putin has not yet been brought to justice and there's no immediate prospect of that, nonetheless, life is very restricted for them. There are many places they can't go. Putin didn't go to the BRICS summit in South Africa.
We have reached our statute of limitations. I'm afraid we've run out of time. Thank you to all of my guests, Lina Sinjab, the BBC's Middle East correspondent, Philippe Sands, 38 Londres Street, and Kenneth Roth's Righting Wrongs are both out now. Next week, Shahida Bari is going to be looking at the place Christianity holds in society. But for now, thank you and goodbye. Thanks for listening to this edition of Start the Week on BBC Radio 4, produced by Katie Hickman. And if you're after more conversations on art, science, history and politics, you can find many, many more on the BBC Sounds website.